Okie doke. Right. Now, GEA games are amateur games. Why is the GEA charging above and beyond for Joe Soap to watch amateur sports? I don't know, but you're already paying $25 million towards the GEA through your taxation. And also, a lot of people out there are also paying your TV license. Greg, I'm a fan of the royal family simply for the fashion and the goss from them makes me laugh at times. It's interesting that regardless of money, they have the same issues as everyone else. They just maybe have a more comfortable version of misery. What a way of putting it. Okay, but they go on to say, but having watched a lot of the coverage from the lip readers as to what was being said among them was interesting. Charles in the carriage giving out, even on the most important day of his life, he was a miserable, moody old man. God help his country, they say. A caller says, why is the cancer centre in Galway? It's unacceptable. It took me 4 hours and 45 minutes to get to Galway Hospital with my uncle 4 years ago. Surely a compromise would be Sligo. It is unacceptable to dismiss the travel aspect for sick people. This is exacerbated by the lack of a motorway, which would go some way to mitigate this. It's time our politicians stood up for us. Health and transport infrastructure are linked in this country, even though our decision makers seem to ignore this. That comes in from Michael there. Thank you for that, Michael. I appreciate it. Just reaching for more of your comments that have been coming in thick and fast. Good morning, Greg. Tourists don't live here. These people have been here well over a year, so the money in their community should be up, not down. If they're spending local, get certainly don't spend local where I live. Only little, yet the real locals are told to shop local. Right, okay. I think that's a person that messaged in a little earlier as well who has an issue with them. Hi, Greg. Could you ask your listeners, have any moved on to stage two of the grant for defective concrete? Have they received an invoice for nearly 20 grand from their engineers to do with stage two? I don't know. We'll throw that out. I'll check up on that, though. A caller says, Carn Donagh is the worst place for parking. Get the council out here and review Grace parking. Everyone here is struggling to get parked and therefore road rage kicks in and the street is filled with angry drivers and cursing. It's a disgrace and an accident will occur here, they say. Right, they say Carn Donagh. Hi, looking for advice here. Short story is we booked €2,000 holiday for last year, 2 days before a sibling died, and we had to cancel. They sent the insurance crowd the death and medical certs. They're now looking for medical records for the year and basically have told us that if they had underlying issues, that we will not be getting our money back. We've rebooked this year, paid a deposit, but as we are in our 60s and our siblings are all older and the majority of our age group have some kind of underlying issues, what's the point of insurance? Okay, that's an interesting one. So they are effectively disputing the insurance claim, are they? They are saying that if the person that passed away, your sibling, had underlying health issues, they won't pay out. Could anyone help us with that? What do you do in that situation? I think lots of people of all different ages might have underlying conditions, and if that means that your insurance is not valid, there's a serious issue there, isn't there? Any advice or help would be greatly appreciated. Greg, when people are asked, do they watch Eurovision? Most people will say publicly they do not, but yet they watch it nonetheless. Okay, we shall see who watches it and who doesn't. We'll get the figures. Right, Helen Martin is Charities Regulator Chief Executive and joins us on the programme now. Good morning, Helen.
Good morning.
It's good to have you with us. Right, okay. A new study has been published into the charities sector, and really I suppose it's public attitudes to them. 9 out of 10 Irish adults donated to charity last year, but 80% say having trust and confidence in a charity is key before deciding to donate. We're a very generous population, aren't we?
We are, Greg, and it's one of those things whereby we've seen it, I think, more so particularly during COVID and also during the Ukraine crisis, you know, people's willingness to get out there and also in response to homelessness causes as well. Homeless and refuge services, for example, would have been one of the top causes that people would have donated to. What we have seen is a fall in the number of people who are donating financially, but we've seen a corresponding rise in terms of people donating goods. Which is another form of donation for charities, and that's something particularly charities that have their own charity shops, they can utilise those goods and earn money from those that they can then put towards their cause, you know, and whatever they're doing in the charity space.
Yeah, I think there were a few instances in recent years that maybe damaged the public's relationship with the charity sector. Is there still a hangover from that? Do people still want the likes of the charities regulator to ensure that charities are everything that they say they are?
Yeah, certainly that came across very strongly in the survey, Greg. It was really around people saying that they want to see more enforcement by the charities regulator. Now, we do a lot of work in the background that wouldn't necessarily be public, because our approach to regulating charities is very much in the first instance where we can to bring charities into compliance. You know, these are organizations largely run by volunteers around the country that are helping, you know, different vulnerable groups. So if there's any chance at all that that the organization can work its way out of whatever non-compliance it found itself in, then we certainly want to be there to support them. Now, in a really small number of cases, you know, you will have to take things a bit further and we'll have to use stronger enforcement powers like appointed inspectors, but there are a very small number of cases. Really, you know, we've 11,500 charities, as you said there. We've 511 in Donegal alone. You know, so there are a lot of charities out there doing great work, but the public has made it really clear that they want to see the charities regulator being more visible around its enforcement. And as I said, we publish a compliance report actually every year where we set out more detail around the kinds of things that we do in the compliance space. It's not all about removing charities from registers or prosecuting volunteers or anything like that. You know, there's lots of other work that goes on behind the scenes to assist charities and to make sure the public's protected.
You talked about the majority of charities, you know, it's people, their donation is running these charities or working for them. Do you think organisations that pay hundreds of thousands of euro to people employed by them should actually be described as charities? Would that help in terms of clarity? I mean, I don't really fancy backing a charity that's paying, you know, 120, 160,000 to someone to be employed by it.
I think there's certainly a perception, and we saw that in the survey, the kind of difficulties that that the public had, you know, were around things like the trust and confidence, the lack of transparency, and also around perceptions around high administration and high salaries. I do think it's really important, though, to look at individual cases. You know, you can't make a general statement that nobody should be paid X, Y, and Z. At the end of the day, charities, certain charities that need employees to deliver their services, and where that's an absolute necessity in order to do what they do, and they do need to pay their employees. But it really does depend on the particular charity. And you know, if you're a charity and you know you've got hundreds and thousands of volunteers and you're helping people, you know, millions of people around the world, then you know you do need, you know, senior management, but also people on the ground with the right skills, and you are competing for those with the private sector. I do think, though, that what came across strong in the survey was the desire for greater transparency. So when we saw people saying trust and confidence was a key indicator, up to 80% now of all adults were saying it's a key factor for them when they're deciding to donate. And what they said is, we want to know where our donations are going, and we want to see evidence of what charities have done. So really, it's about, I think it's about greater transparency and people understanding what a charity is doing, as opposed to, you know, really looking at a particular salary and
but
saying
also,
that's too high.
But also understanding what a charity is. Now, this is perhaps beyond the scope of the charity regulator, but you know, there's a lot of people might be confused as to what a charity is. They may believe they're donating to charity, but in fact they are not.
Yeah, and that definitely came out, Greg, actually, in this survey. So we had people believing that sporting bodies, you know, your local sports clubs, that they're charities. They're not. They're not a charity under our act. In addition to that, people believing that, you know, commercial entities like online platforms, you know, that like we'll say GoFundMe, that they believe that those were charities, when in fact they're services that charities use and lots of other bodies use in order to raise funds. So yeah, there was definitely some interesting things there as to what people thought were charities. Also, I think people don't understand necessarily the breadth of what the charity sector entails. So, you know, when you go to a museum, you go to, you know, a religious service, maybe a mass, your kids are going to university or schools or scouts, community creches. I mean, it's a huge sector, and it's very, very diverse. And what we would say to everybody, though, is that, you know, if you're kind of scratching your head and wondering if an entity is a charity or not, if you go on to charitiesregulator.ie, there's a register of charities all Irish registered charities are there, and you'll be able to find details about the charity, you know, about their finances, their volunteers, whether they've paid staff or not, and also details around their activities.
Mm-hmm. Do you believe there needs to be more regulation, like, say, for instance, you know, single issue fundraisers that are done through the likes of GoFundMe and others are available? Because, you know, we would get contacts in the past where people will have donated, right, but then they don't know where the money actually went. There's no sort of accountability thereafter. If you have a registered charity, presumably at some point you can seek, or it's published, what is actually happening with the money. I'm just concerned, or maybe people should be concerned, that, you know, once bitten, twice shy, that someone who maybe backs an individual cause and then is dissatisfied with it might then, you know, be reluctant to donate into the future. Is there any scope, do you think, or should there be any scope for the likes of the charities regulator to be extended to sort of bring in these individual drives for some sort of regulation or accountability?
Well, I think we're limited to charities. So when you talk about those individual issues, so, for example, collecting for a child who might be sick, for example, that wouldn't meet the charity test because there's no public benefit to that. It's very much to benefit the individual. And I think the flip side of that is, you know, do you want to limit people's ability to raise important funds like that for sick children? You know, I think what is important is that people inform themselves and that they are absolutely confident that they are giving to, if they intend to give to a charity, make sure it is in fact a registered charity. I can't really speak to any other kind of funding, Greg, but I would always say to people, be very careful, because at the end of the day, there are so many good causes out there that are crying out for funding. So it's important that organisations, you know, that are not charities, or certainly that are unclear. Mm-hmm. I mean, if people are collecting for single issue funding, and this is just my own personal view, I'd always be looking to see, well, how much have they set a limit on what they're looking? Because if it's legitimate, they should know exactly what how much they need to collect, how much the treatment is. And then do they have a commitment as to what they'll do with the additional funds if they make more than they planned on making?
Maybe you don't feel it's really up to you as such to comment on how we are changing, in that you talk about we're more inclined now than in the past to donate goods and less inclined to donate cash. Obviously, we've been dealing with the homelessness and refugee situation. Are people throwing what they have, resources in that regard? That's what might sort of suggest why we're seeing a switch from cash to actual goods, and that means other services that might benefit from cash are missing out. Can you talk to that at all, or maybe it's a bit of whataboutery for me? But I just wonder, you know.
I think it's a good question, Greg, because you do, you know, obviously, as you rightly point out, not every charity has a charity shop. You know, that's not the way that a lot of charities earn the donations from the public that they really need. So there's certainly a worry there. What I would say, though, it is positive, though, because the amount that the people who are giving now in terms of money has gone up over the last couple of years. So that's certainly positive. And then I think, you know, when you look at things like donated goods, I think there's lots of things going on there. You know, there is a cost of living crisis. So, you know, it perhaps shows that people, why they might not have as much money to give, certainly want to keep giving to charities. And that's in recognition of the important work that they do. So, I think there's certainly, it wouldn't be true to say that all charities, you know, are funded in the same way. And I think that's what it's really important for people to understand, the charities that they support and the charities that they, you know, want to make sure continue, that they understand how those charities are funded and that they give in the most effective way to those charities.
Schools are charities, aren't they?
Schools are charities, schools are charities, universities, scouts, community creches, museums. Yeah, there's a huge number of organisations and types of organisations there.
And the website, Helen, if anyone wants to check the list of charities.
It's charitiesregulator.ie. Okay. And just look at the register of charities there, and you can put in any name and you'll find out whether they're a registered charity or not.
Thanks for your time today. Have a lovely one.
Okay, thanks, Greg.
Bye-bye. Helen Martin, Charities Regulator, CEO. We have a defective block campaigner and homeowner in Paddy Diver joining us. Hi, Paddy. Thanks for coming back on the show.
How's it going, Greg?
Not too bad. Right, we're at a critical point, are we, of this campaign, in that the very important issues that we believe need addressed, we'll know very shortly if those concerns have been taken on board. This is the final push, is it?
Yeah, it seems to be. Nothing that's getting the stage now. These coming close, these regs are supposed to come out. What we're hearing back, there's going to be no wild changes to them. That makes us massively worried, because if that's the case, then the scheme's not fit for purpose. That's just the bottom line. And there was a meeting up in the Dunning, up in Letterkenny last night, and it was put to the Fianna Fáil councillors. Is there any news? There was no news. So they were putting them, tell them what the problems were at the moment that they're facing and all the rest. And there's a lot of heckling, there's a lot of arguing more or less back and forth. And I've come down to the point then that the Fianna Fáil councillors was there. There was Kieran Brogan was there, your man Donal, Charlie, your man Niall Blaney. They were all there. And when I was put to them, if I think a scheme's fit for purpose, none, yes or no answers. None of them could say yes. The silence was deafening at the top of the table. And if that's the case, then anything that Fianna Fáil council out there, they shouldn't be supporting this party. Because another party, man, of Dara Breen, the Minister of Housing, he's there, he's got the gift for the people of Donegal. And it's obvious that he's not going to give it. He gives the Leinster two end to ends. They get accommodation. They get, up in Donegal, you get 15,000. That 15,000 is not going to last long unless there's a plan in place. And that's the biggest problem up here. There's no plan, no project plan. Mm. There was a woman down there, in Letterkenny. She had three children with her. And she just emptied her heart and told exactly what's been on. She's nowhere to go. No money. She can't get on the scheme. There's no money to get on the scheme. But she can't wait till this new scheme comes out and the regs come out. Then they'll wait another lock of months. No, there's no plan in place for emergency homing. That's what she's more or less turning around and saying. She's got three children. She's living in a house that's unsafe to live in. That shouldn't be happening today. And that's the Minister of Housing's gift to give. Like, how can a scheme be going on? The biggest scheme in the history of land, 2.7 billion. And there's not even a cabin, an emergency home, a modular home, whatever way you want to call it. And we pockets of towns around the place. So people, bad enough with what they're going through. But to have to operate your children, take them out of schools. Like, the woman bore her soul. And the Charlie and them, they couldn't find a hunt here. She goes and walked out.
There's a... Yeah, the meeting has been confirmed of chairpersons of the four defective bloc campaign groups, including MAG. They're having a virtual meeting with the Minister for Housing tomorrow. What is expected of that meeting? Is this where we find out whether or not he's going to take on board some of these key concerns? Do you know what that meeting's about and what we can expect from it, if anything, Paddy?
Greg, I've been in all them meetings when we were in the working group meetings. It's just going to be talking shop. He's going to turn around and say, yeah, take what you're saying on board, I'll get back to you. I don't expect nothing to come out of that meeting, because the homeowners, really and truly, have no input into this here. They're turning around to the Donegal County Council and ask the mayor. I don't know if they have any input. If they really and truly if they don't implement things better, well, I don't know where that scheme's going.
Well, what happens next then? Like, say, for instance, the cap remains. Say, for instance, people can't get on the scheme because they don't have tens of thousands of euro to pay. Say, for instance, an older person can't transfer, their house onto someone else who can... Exactly. You know, say stuff like, say we don't know what the story is with foundations. Like, what happens next? Because it's just going to be devastating for that person that you talked of, that lady last night, is one of thousands of others, many that don't even know they're going to be affected by this yet. What happens next if this scheme, the final scheme, is unworkable?
I'd love to be able to give you an answer, but I don't know myself, Greg. I've been down in Dublin and I went down and watched whenever the people blocked the ports, whenever it went against the East Wall Street. I've seen them doing it for two solid weeks. It didn't make them blink an eye to that government. There's no point in the Donegal ones coming down and thinking of blocking a port for one day is going to make a change, because it wouldn't. I'd love to say that we thought if we'd done a protest down there, that it would. I don't know where to go next, but all I do know is up in the Greenian Hotel, that's where all the people need to pull their heads together. There's a working group going on at the minute. There's over 100 people turning up to now. So before, when it was just right to the 50-year protest in Dublin, it needs more thinking. It needs more strategy of what's going next, if this is still the case, what they're doing. Because, as you say, we've got pensioners out there that all they want in the last rollouts of their lives is a transfer of eligibility. They deserve that right in the last rollouts of their lives. And it's a gift to give from the Minister of Housing. It's not no extra money to Exchequer. It's an absolute disgrace that it's not even on the table or that it's not agreed on yet. There's so much stuff like that on the foundations, etc. I don't know where it's going next, but I would ask anybody that if they have any good plans, And if that means...
But Paddy, is the reality... Is the
Yeah,
but is the reality, Paddy, at this stage, and I don't want to be negative, that, you know, by the time we get a decision on the science side of things, on foundations, they're talking about that being early next year, so you could probably kick that in towards the end of the year, and an election is just around the corner. Is this really a case of waiting to see what happens post-next election? Whomever's in government, we don't know who's going to be in government. In other words... Is that really the reality of this situation, that the best hope is that there is something secured in the process of and post an election?
Yeah, listen, I'd be tempted to agree with you massively. Like, me personally, if I had to turn around to somebody there and they had just hairline cracks in their house, I'd be telling them, stay away from my scheme. I'd just forget about it for a couple of years, because really and truly, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, they've set their stall. They don't care about the people. Sinn Féin, if we have a chance to have a Minister of Finance in Donegal, and we've got Owen O'Brien as the Minister of Housing that is really shows that, like, that he cares, we're going to have to put our full faith in Sinn Féin. And we've seen before in the Dáil, they're asking all the hard questions. I'm not trying to sway the people politically, stay away from Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael, but how could even a Fianna Fáil councillor even represent this party whenever the voting comes in, if this party's turned their back on the people? So me personally, yeah, I would be thinking that's the way to go. I don't think I have enough time to wait. I don't even know if I'll have the money. I'll have to wait to see that the scheme comes out. There's a lot of other people that houses are in that dangerous, that they need something to happen today. But anybody else, I would definitely wait in to see if something's going to follow through with what they've said they have, because this scheme at the moment, it looks like it's not fit for purpose. And it's all well and good people turning around saying, we'll reject the scheme. Aye, listen, I'd reject the scheme. I'm sure Mike would reject the scheme. But what us rejecting a scheme doesn't stop the scheme from going ahead. That's the big problem here.
Okay. What did you mention is happening, Alan Green, on? Is there a meeting on today?
No.
Oh, that was yesterday,
Thursday night up in the Greenian.
Okay.
There's a working group committee. A lot of stuff will go on and through with the there's banking groups and the science group. They're looking for people kind of to get on about the quarries, because the quarries are still going on and it's growing. And there's another thing when I was on about with the banking group there. People have probably seen what was being said there in the last couple of days of the terms and conditions of the mortgages. Now, this is just to take a scare factor away from the people. Dara Breen, he's come out more or less, you've probably seen in the Business Post, he's more or less implemented that he's in talks with the banks. Well, listen, that's not the case, because Pascal Donoghue 5 years says they're in talks with the banks. Dara Breen then says they're in talks with the banks. There's none of them in talks with the banks until a couple of smart people in the working group, smarter than me, have really found on the terms and conditions that you're technically in default of your mortgage if you don't notify the banks that you're going for demolition. And what that means is the banks then need to know that their house is fixed to satisfactory condition. So they can't guarantee this fixed to satisfactory condition unless about the foundations. So generally, this is not just to do with the demolitions. This is everybody, as every home is in technical default.
Look, at the end of the day, the only way this works is if full demolition and new foundations, really. I can't see any other way that this works, that everyone's covered and indemnified and secure, unless it's full demolition with the foundations. Anything else is just, it seems nonsensical to me.
Yeah, well, I agree 100%. And that means, thus by you getting onto your banks, if the banks want it fixed back to a full satisfactory condition, well, the banks will be demanding the same. And when they're running talks with the government, they'll be saying the same, so we have more chance of getting it. It's the same as this banking group now have a meeting with the man Brian Hayes. He's the CEO of the Banking Federation, and he's bringing all the banks to the table, along with the working group. And that's just what we're going to be demanding. Because as far as we're knowing at the moment, the engineers, they are not signing off on the remedial work.
I wouldn't.
They're not going to sign off on it.
Nor would I buy a house built on foundations built with the same concrete. I wouldn't try and even get a mortgage on that.
No, I agree massively. But that's all boils down to here. You've got the campaigners that all say the same thing. But it all boils down to Fianna Fáil at the minute, the Minister of Housing. No wonder there was a conference plan against him, because at the minute, it's shambolic the way he's treating the people of Donegal as second-class citizens.
All right, the line's going to Potnos. Paddy, thanks for that. Take care of yourself. Paddy Diffa there, defective block campaigner and homeowner, and I am sure if they were here, the Fianna Fáil councillors would say that they're making these representations on behalf of their constituents. And I'm sure, too, Dara O'Brien would argue that he's delivering a multi-billion, multi-annual scheme. You know yourself, I'm just trying to put the counter-arguments there that might well exist. Unfortunately, I can't speak to Minister Charlie McConnell. He won't come on this programme any longer. He's made that really quite clear. The claim being that I'm anti-government when I'm not. I'm actually, and that's it. This has been said at various Fianna Fáil meetings around the county as well, that I am anti-government and that he doesn't feel he gets a fair crack of the whip and he won't come on this programme any longer. So that's why you haven't heard him on this programme. It's not because we haven't invited him. I've always tried to be fair. I have to ask questions about a defective concrete block scheme that affects thousands of people out there, but it's been deemed that I am anti-government in doing so, and the general tone, which I am not, but we represent people's issues here. If you're going to talk about health, okay, within whose gift is it to fix that? It is the government ultimately responsible. If you're going to talk about housing, it's the government ultimately responsible. If you're going to talk about roads infrastructure, it's not anti-government, okay, but you'd have to be really sensitive to believe that these conversations, whereas we try and help people as best as we can, are anti-government. I would love to be able to put some of these questions to Minister McConnell, but he no longer will come on this programme stating for the reason that it's to do with me. He'll come on if Donald's here, but not me, because he believes that I'm anti-government, which I am not, because as soon as there is a change of government, all the same issues will be there. The tone of the programme will be the same. I try as best as I can to be fair and to give people a voice and to be as balanced as possible. And we've got loads of people from all different political persuasions that come on the programme. There's no issue there whatsoever. I haven't said it before, but I know people will pull up and say, well, why can't you get this question or that question answered? I would like to. I would hope that the majority of people believe that I am fair and not anti anyone in particular. But as I say, unfortunately, going forward, that's one voice you won't be able to hear in this programme unless Donald's on or someone else. I don't know. It's up to people what they want to do. And there's an interesting further to that story as well in terms of, well, I won't go into it, but there's other elements to that as well, which I won't say. But wouldn't be best practice, I would suggest. But anyway, listen, it is what it is. We'll continue to invite, of course. There's not much else we can do. Right, so Ireland is introducing new hate speech legislation. The old laws date back to 1989, but are seen as ineffective. There are only about 50 convictions under it, and that led to calls for a major overhaul. It also comes at a time when the internet has dramatically changed the climate and a potentially incendiary video can be seen by thousands in minutes. The new legislation launched by government last year has attracted criticism from some quarters, not just here in Ireland, but abroad as well. However, it sailed through the door by an overwhelming majority and is now being considered by the Senate. The new proposals criminalise communications or behaviour that's likely to incite violence or hatred against people because they're associated with a protected characteristic. It also says those characteristics are race, colour, nationality, religion, national or ethnic origin, descent, gender, sex characteristics, sexual orientations and disabilities. We've heard from the likes of Elon Musk, who described them as a massive attack on freedom of expression. Donald Trump Jr. tweeted it's insane, and others too. Are a party that argue that part of the proposed law goes too far. Let's say hello to a number of guests. I'll say first hello to Fine Gael Deputy Joe McHugh, who joins us. Joe, good morning to you. Thanks very much for taking the time out this morning.
No problem, Greg. Sorry, I was trying to get to the office there, but I got delayed, so I'm coming from the car here. But don't worry, I'm parked up here.
Yep, no problem. And the reception's perfect, so that is good. Have you any concerns about this at this point? Because it seems to have just come to public consciousness really quite recently. Is there anything in this process that sort of made you pause for thought?
Yeah, look, I do have concerns with respect to the campaign now, following the fifth stage being approved last week. Obviously, there are genuine concerns, and I've been, you know, reading different right activists and highlighting their concerns. So there is an opportunity in the Senate this week to put through amendments where they'll be accepted or not by the government. I'm not too sure. But the one thing that I've been very supportive on this particular piece of legislation from day one, when Minister Helen McEntee introduced it, that it is aiming to be very specific to racism, xenophobia, and the protection of vulnerable minority groups. So in that regard, I was always supportive of the legislation. But one thing that will need to happen here, if, for example, if none of these amendments in the Senate are accepted, it will go to the judiciary as well, because a big part of the legislation is to train up the judiciary, and also to for the judiciary actually to find ground in terms of what's the definition. I know a few deputies try to define what hatred is and incitement is. But look, the world has changed. The world is changing. There is a lot of rage online, on the internet. But it's wider than just incitement and hatred and xenophobia and racism. That rage is wider than that. But I think we have to be very careful with this, and where people do highlight concerns, we have to be very cautious.
Yeah, because, you know, there are some people that feel that the reason this passed through the door so quickly and so unanimously is because it's politicians that are maybe trying to protect themselves. It seems to come off the back of, you know, protests outside politicians' homes, videos being made, politicians being approached by citizens, journalists in the street. Obviously there's levels of criticism socially online. I don't think anyone wants someone's, say, for instance, sexuality or race to be brought into it. But there are people that feel that type of protest or freedom of expression could be curtailed. And that's why politicians are so in favour of it, because you could say that they're at the sharp end of it at the moment. And I think that's what's called causing concerns here.
Yeah, and I've heard those arguments as well. But one, there's a specific element to this legislation, and it's for it's in relation to xenophobia and racism, minority groups, people, you know, from different countries, different religions, different creeds, different races, and it's to try to stop that hatred and for consequences. And you know, nobody more than the Irish, you know, go back over our own history, whether what is in a pub in London, having signage up, you know, no dogs, no Irishmen allowed in. Like we suffered those prejudices as well. And I think we have to ensure that, if that is the motivation behind this, that we have to be very, very specific, and the judiciary has to be very specific around that, because it's important that governments are critiqued, it's important that politicians are criticised, it's important that people have a platform to give their opinion and not to be afraid to give their opinion as well, and to be critical should not fall into the realms of this.
But how do we, under these use laws, say, for instance, have a debate or a conversation about trans people having access to women's toilets, for an example? So say someone comes on to a programme like this, and I mean this with no offence to anyone, but it have to sort of give an example for the purpose of the conversation, that comes on to a programme like this and says, I don't want trans people using women's toilets because that effectively is a man in a dress. Now, that would be seen, I'd imagine, as hate speech towards someone's gender that they identify. I mean, do you believe a statement like that should be criminalised, or perhaps could be criminalised, that if we had a conversation about transgenderism, that if someone misgendered someone in that way, that could be seen as hate speech? How could that be a positive thing?
Well, I think this is why Minister Brown, when he was contributing last week in the Dáil, he was asked to define it, and he very much was of the opinion that the judiciary has to be very, very clear and very, very transparent in what is the incitement of hatred. And I know there were examples used of the incitement of hatred in Wales and Scotland, and Northern Ireland was referenced as well. I think there's going to have to be very, very clear lines. Number one, defining what actual hatred is, incitement is, but also to ensure that debate is needed. There's going to be an enormous amount of change in the time ahead, and whether that's rights for transgender or rights for people from minority backgrounds and different ethnic communities, it's important that there is also room for debate, room for argument, room for discussion on shows like yourself, that people aren't afraid to do that.
Yeah. Okay. Listen, I appreciate your time. I know you've got other appointments, so I'm going to let you go. Thanks, Joe.
Thanks, Greg.
All right, take care of yourself. We have other guests to bring in on this because Sinn Féin has been criticised, really, as the opposition for just allowing this to go through without, you know, maybe triggering further debate at the early stages of it. Pa Daly, Sinn Féin spokesperson on Justice. Pa, thanks very much for taking your time. I'll put it to you the same question before we tease out your stance on this more generally. Do you know, like, are you or do you have any concerns that these types of rules and regulations could stifle debate? Or is it really about protecting people and their right to exist without fear of abuse?
Yeah, well, good morning, Greg, and good morning to all the listeners in Donegal. And I'm delighted to be on the show. And if I could just say at the start, I have a good affinity with Donegal. My grandfather lived in Tory Island for a few years as a child, and we had a couple of good holidays when I was a child in Glencullum Kill.
Good to hear.
But just to take up your point that you were made, and you made the point yourself, Greg, that maybe politicians are only bringing this about now because of the protests outside their offices, and indeed there was one outside my own office. But no, this legislation has been going through various different processes for about 5 or 6 years now. It all started, and as Joe quite rightly said, you know, Irish people should be able to empathise with immigrant communities. And Ireland had one of the highest rates of hate crime against people of an African background, for example. And the ICCL, there was a 2-year international research program commenced in order to look into what can we do, because as you said, Greg, the previous 1989 legislation was ineffective. And within the criminal justice process, it was very difficult to prosecute anyone. So it was felt by all sides, NGOs and a lot of politicians, that it was important to send a clear message that racist type behaviour is not acceptable. Now, one of the points that you made there about having the debate, and if I could address that at the start, in any proceedings for a lot, there's been a lot of debate about Section 10, which is preparing or possessing material. But in any proceeding, it's a defence to show that it's a reasonable and genuine contribution to literary, artistic, political, religious or academic discourse. So that would certainly cover a show like yours discussing the type of debate that
but
that
if
mentioned.
I had if I yeah but if I was sent a WhatsApp message, right, that was racist, okay, in a group,
yeah,
or something,
yeah,
and that was found on my device, okay, under the legislation, if I'm reading it correctly, I would actually have to prove that I didn't have that on my device with a view to using it to incite hatred or to an offender group. That's what's being circulated in the on social media.
You are correct. Now, I'm not on Twitter myself, but there has been a lot of talk on Twitter about it from the likes of, you mentioned, Elon Musk, Donald Trump's son. And I was speaking to my colleagues, Padraig McLaughlin, mm-hmm, Pierce Doherty, who, like every single member of the Dáil, have been receiving a lot of emails, a lot of which were sent to every single member of the Dáil. And it's false and it's without foundation to say that people could be arrested or questioned for simply having items on their material on their phone. That's wrong. And we have received a lot of other emails saying that, oh, if it's for politicians, if there's a problem created by their policies and if there's an adverse reaction, that's what this legislation is about, that we want to stop thought crime or create a thought crime and silence legitimate opinions. No. In addition to the defence that I mentioned already in Section 10, there is also in Section 11 a protection of freedom of expression, so that it says that any material is not taken to incite violence by just having a discussion or a criticism of a protected characteristic. Mm. So you would have to...
Well, Paul, what are your concerns?
Have material. I just finished.
Okay, go ahead.
Point, Greg. You have to prepare the material or possess it where it's likely to incite violence or hatred. Mm-hmm. So, and as well as that, the DPP has to be involved in any type of prosecutions. Mm-hmm. So, you know, while there is all those protections, and while there is some people, mostly I would say on the right, who are ramping it up on Twitter in particular to say that it's, you know, thoughts will be criminalized, merely possessing will be criminalized. That's not the case. Having said that, we have had concerns over this while it was going through committee stage and first and second stage of the bill.
Okay.
And if I can just say that we put in amendments at committee stage. We did have concerns about the definition of hatred. Our concerns were somewhat allayed by giving flexibility and the fact, as I think you mentioned, Greg, about the way that this whole scene is developing and has been developing over the years, and you have to give judges some types of flexibility. But some people are saying that you're possessing it and you're being reckless as to whether it is likely to cause violence or hatred towards a certain amount of people. But recklessness, without getting too legal on it, Greg, is defined as unjustifiably taking action while consciously disregarding any risks to people. So, if I was at a wedding in the Abbey Hotel in Donegal and I had a pint glass in my hand and I threw it up in the air over my shoulder, then you're being reckless, but you're consciously disregarding what's happening. So this legislation is having material which is likely to incite violence or hatred.
Okay.
And simply have it, to answer your question in a roundabout way, Greg, simply having it on your phone would not be enough, would simply not be enough.
Okay.
And there is a lot of mistruths, if I could call them that, out there, which, we have to think, if we were in government, what would we be doing in Sinn Féin? And we have to take some sort of a responsible attitude towards us, dealing with the problems that are clearly out there in a rise in xenophobia and racism in particular. And we met recently a group of students who were in college who are, black and Indian, and it was actually staggering the amount of racist, not only comments, but assaults that are taking place on those students who are, a lot of whom are Irish, and have been born here, and their parents have lived here for many years.
Paul,
so
listen,
it's important to take a stand against that, Greg, and I think that most reasonable people, notwithstanding the fact that we must raise certain concerns in relation to aspects of the bill, and we certainly did that in committee stage, and we will be doing so again in the Senate.
Paul Daly, Sinn Féin spokesman on justice, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it. Regular guest historian Dr. Joe Kelly joins us on the programme as well. Listening there patiently, Joe, I appreciate your time, but it's not the type of conversation too I want to cut people off in until they conclude their points. You had concerns just before you talk about them. Anything that you heard from either deputy there has allayed any of your concerns?
Well, look, I don't want to get political on this, but one has to. I think PA needs to do a bit of reflection. Like, have Sinn Féin forgotten the Section 5 of the Broadcasting Act that silenced them? And Gerry Adams, you'd see his mouth moving but no talk. I mean, freedom of speech is fundamental to our constitution. It's in Article 46.1, express freely their convictions and opinions.
But that's freedom of expression, not freedom of speech.
But that expression of a conviction is an opinion. How else will you express it but orally or graphically or whatever way it is? But in the same article, Greg, and this is where the dishonesty is, the same article of the Constitution says that the publication or utterances of seditious or indecent matter is an offence and should be punished by the law. There are acts already in place to deal with these kind of hate speeches. And if we look at the Prohibition Act or Incitement to Hatred Act 1989, which Deputy Joe McHugh did rightly mention, but there's also an Online Safety Act in place. There's an Online Safety Commissioner in the pipeline. There's the Charter of EU Rights. There are acts and instruments within the law to deal with this already. And as far as I'm concerned, this is an unconstitutional law. It's what the TDs have actually voted for is repugnant to Article 28A, Article 15.4.1, which states that if the Eritas introduces a law that is repugnant to the law, then it's invalid. The very proposal of a hate speech law breaches Article 46.1. And see, the thing is, The question then is, who's pushing this hate speech law?
Well, answer that question.
Well, for example, I mean, you had Patrick McGowan on yesterday. I was listening to him there about how the government had closed down local county councils, as in the town councils and so forth. Are an ordinary, good, hard-working men and women, for example, in Donegal County Council and the length and breadth of the 26 county, other counties, or 25 counties in Ireland, I've never heard one of them asking for this hate speech law. It's coming from the top down. And they're having to bow to their masters and do what they're told. The councillors are under the constitution to debate, discuss issues that are relevant to the people that they represent. This hasn't come from the people. This hasn't come from the ordinary councillors. And we have to be very careful to distinguish the good, hard working of all parties across this county who are in a way disjuncted from their masters in Dublin, who will tell them what to think and what to say. And an example of that for recently was the Union Jack. Now, whether you were for or against, when the Queen died, they asked that the Union Jack would be at half mast in the Donegal County Council office. The councillors didn't get to discuss this. This was, the tricolour would be half mast. This was a diktat laid on the councillors. So one has to be careful when we're criticising politicians and who we're holding to account. And our ARPTA's members, as far as I'm concerned, are trying to introduce a law. And you raised a very interesting question. Why? They talk about the protected characteristics. Who decides what group of people does the hate speech infringe upon? And will that eventually over time be expanded to include the politicians? And as far as I'm concerned, this is a grab by the political elite to shut us up.
Okay. Will you come back on for further debate on this with us, Joe?
Absolutely. Can I just make one point?
One more point, please, yeah.
Hate speech was already there in the Weimar Republic of 1922, which jailed Goebbels and other Nazi leaders. 1922, this is 33 was when Hitler came to power. It didn't work. Hate speech laws does not work. What you need is actually to flush people out and to speak, and then good people to take them on and say, no, you're wrong. This has been proven again and again, and scholars have shown it. This is a grab by the political elite, as far as I'm concerned, to shut us up. And you know what? People in Donegal know that there's something wrong. We're not going to be fooled. And that's something that we need really to debate about. And one more thing. You said to me a very powerful question, which others have commented on. When did we, in the last conversation I had with you in the history slot, when did we become complacent and complicit? And you know something, Greg? That question you posed, I tried to answer it as best I could on the day, but that was a personal enlightenment to me, that question that you raised. And I started to think about what you said. When have we become complacent and complicit? It's time we start to think about who we have representing us.
Okay.
And it's like the goldfish bowl, we're going round and round, and then we get around and say, God, we've not been here before. Politicians need to be accountable,
okay.
Not every 5 years, every day.
Joe, we're going to have you back on to debate this further. Thank you very much indeed. Okay, last but not least, we have Fionnuala Rabbitt, President of the Letterkenny Chamber, in with us. Fionnuala, thanks so much for calling in.
No problem at all.
At the end of the show. It's some important news because there's a significant event coming up on the 9th of June.
Absolutely. This is the first time we've been able to hold this event in the last couple of years. So my predecessor sadly didn't get to have it. But what we are doing is we are bringing back the President's Lunch. And we're very excited about it this year. I personally am very excited about it because it's actually somebody that I've never met before in person. So I'm really looking forward to meeting her and actually hearing her speak. And our speaker on the day is going to be Mary Lou McDonald.
She's making the keynote speech.
Yeah,
okay.
She is our guest and our keynote speaker. So the way the luncheon happens, it starts at 12 o'clock. It's on the 9th of June in the Radisson Hotel. You come down around 12 and there'll be like greeting drinks in the afternoon. Then we sit down and we have a nice lunch. I speak. Sadly, I will be very quick and fast, I promise. And then we get to hear from Mary Lou and see what her thoughts are and the party's thoughts, Sinn Féin's feelings in particular, with regard to business and investment in the Northwest in particular. So that's something we're very interested to hear more about. Following that, then obviously we'll all sit around and we'll have lunch, and then we have a very exciting panel discussion which will be coming towards the end of the lunch, very kindly going to be hosted by yourself. And we have some key speakers from around Donegal that are in large organisations here and big employers across the county.
Which so are amazingly powerful voices, because what we're talking about here, is it, Fionnuala? We're talking about where we're at. Yes. And that's positives as well as where there are gaps, but also where we're going. And obviously Letterkenny, but the county and the Northwest City region element to it as well. And, you know, it's very possible Mary Lou McDonald could be the future Taoiseach. I'm sure she might be at some point. But so we're going to get a where we're at, where we're going conversation. I think it's going to be really useful.
Well, I think that's going to be the interesting thing. And like you say, I mean, there's a very good possibility that Ms. McDonald herself may be the leader. But if not, there is a definite possibility, you could put a few pound on it, that at some point Sinn Féin are going to be in a position of power within the government of the Republic. So it's definitely that we want to build ties with the party, build ties with... I know they have a strong relationship with Donegal, but I think it's important to start focusing on the future of business. You know, there's oftentimes where there's discussions about wealth and things like that, and is Sinn Féin for wealth generation, or what their stance is on with regard to business. And I think this is an important time for businesses and for the business community in Letterkenny in particular, but obviously it is open to people outside.
And I think it's also important even for opposition to hear directly. You know what I mean? Even if it's not in government, for opposition to actually hear directly from the big players and
the
smaller players in this process. So it is...
It gives us an opportunity to tell her, these are our concerns. These are what we feel that this region needs in the next few years. This is what's important, that the money comes to Letterkenny in particular, but also to the region. Mm. And in order to sustain the growth in population that we've seen, in order to sustain lifestyles, in order to just sustain the county and the region.
I'm very interested to hear what you have to say because it's you and on behalf of the chamber and the business community as well. Because that is the lead in to the keynote speaker, Mary Lou McDonald, which makes it all the more important. The expert panel is going to be a representation of business leaders from manufacturing, education, technology, talking, as I say, about where we're at, where we're going. And also there's a drinks reception and lunch as well. With all that in mind, tickets are priced actually really quite competitively, I think, at €45 for chamber members, €55 for non-members. Booking is required. Those tickets are going to go quick.
I would get on it right away. The words booking is required. I'd say in this instance, booking is essential.
Yeah.
You can go to the Chamber website and you can book via the Chamber website. So if people want to log on to the Chamber website, anybody that has any problems booking can contact the Chamber office. But I would say booking is essential. The numbers will be restricted. There's only so many people we can fit into the room, and to make it, you know, we don't want to have it everybody cheek to jowl. So you want to kind of have it nice and relaxed, where people can find out exactly, where we stand as a chamber, and then where what we're pushing in our lobbying works and that kind of thing as well, going forward and into the future.
All right, that's all on the 9th of June. Tickets are limited. Please book at letterkennychamber.com. €45 for chamber members, €55 for non-members. You have a speech from Chamber President Fionnuala Rabbit, then the keynote speaker, Sinn Féin leader Mary Lou McDonald, and then that panel following lunch of Donegal business leaders. Thank you so much for that. Okay, that's where we have to leave it on the show.